The following recording is for Phoebe Sylag with Economic Policy Institute on Tuesday, January 15th, 2013 at 11 a.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have the speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given if you would like to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to Richard Rothstein. Mr. Rothstein, you may begin.
Thank you very much. In our new report, What Do International Tests Really Show About American Student Performance?, we disaggregate international student test scores by social class, and we show that the commonplace condemnation of U.S. student performance on such tests is misleading, exaggerated, and in many cases based on misinterpretation of the facts. Ours is the first study of which we're aware to compare the performance of socioeconomically similar students across nations. Both of the major international tests, TIMSS, the Third International Mathematics and Science Survey, and PISA, the Program on International Student Assessment, eventually published not only average scores, but a rich database from which analysts can disaggregate scores by student socioeconomic characteristics, their school composition, and other criteria. Examining these can lead to more nuanced conclusions than those suggested from average national scores alone. Although TIMSS published average national results in December, it only plans to release its underlying database 2 days from now. We find this procedure a little bit puzzling because it ensures that commentators will draw quick but ill-informed interpretations, and that policymakers can offer inappropriate interpretations of the results without fear of contradiction from the underlying data. Analysis of the database takes time, and headlines from the initial release get sealed in conventional wisdom before scholars can complete more careful study. The careful analysis that we think we've done of PISA shows that the achievement gap between disadvantaged and advantaged children is actually smaller in the United States than it is in similar countries. The achievement gap in the United States is larger than it is in the very highest scoring countries, but even then many of the differences are small. What's more, an examination of trends over the last decade on multiple administrations of both TIMSS and PISA shows that the achievement of the most disadvantaged U.S. adolescents has been increasing rapidly, while the achievement of similarly disadvantaged adolescents in some countries that are typically held up as examples for the United States, Finland, for example, has been falling just as rapidly. Thus, while the reading achievement on PISA of the lowest social class U.S. students grew by more than two-tenths of a standard deviation from 2000 to 2009, it fell by an even larger amount in Finland. In math, the lowest social class U.S. students also posted substantial gains, while scores of comparable Finnish students declined. This is surprising because the proportion of disadvantaged students in Finland also fell, and we might expect this to make the task of devoting resources to them easier. Certainly, even for the lowest social class students, Finland's scores remain higher than ours, but examination of trends as well as levels challenges the easy assumption that simply imitating Finnish education is the recipe for U.S. success. Once aware of these data trends, it would be perverse for policymakers to conclude from international test comparisons that we should upend how we educate disadvantaged youngsters. While American schools can certainly do better with disadvantaged children, it seems that our educational system may have more serious problems with the more advantaged students relative to other nations. Since the last PISA release in 2010, we've been digging deeper into its database, as well as into the older databases for TIMSS and for both versions of our domestic National Assessment of Educational Progress, which you probably know as NAEP. We concentrated on scores of adolescents, that is 8th graders in TIMSS and NAEP, and 15-year-olds on PISA, which are the closest comparable ages. In the United States, in three top-scoring countries, in Canada, Finland, and Korea, and in three similar post-industrial countries, France, Germany, and the UK. The share of disadvantaged students in the U.S. sample was larger than their share in any of the other countries we studied. Because test scores in every country are characterized by a social class gradient. Students higher in the social class scale have better average achievement than students in the next lower class. U.S. student scores are lower on average simply because of our relatively disadvantaged social class composition. This social class-driven distortion was compounded because in 2009, PISA oversampled low-income U.S. students who attended schools with very high proportions of similarly disadvantaged students, artificially lowering the apparent U.S. score. While 40% of the PISA sample was drawn from schools where half or more of students were eligible for free and reduced-price lunch, only 23% of students nationwide attend such schools. Our report shows that if we make two reasonable adjustments to the reported U.S. average, our international ranking improves. The first adjustment reweights the social class composition of U.S. test takers to the average composition of top-scoring countries. The other reweights the distribution of lunch-eligible students by the actual intensity of such students in schools. These adjustments raise the U.S. international ranking on the 2009 PISA test from 14th to 4th in reading and from 25th to 10th in mathematics. While there's still room for improvement, these are quite respectable showings. A unique aspect of our report is our consolidation of trend data from all four assessments, PISA, TIMSS, and the two forms of NAEP. From 2000 to 2006, U.S. math scores on PISA fell substantially, causing great alarm among U.S. policymakers and pundits. But few noticed that during roughly the same period, U.S. math scores on TIMSS were rising, as they did on the main NAEP. We cannot attribute this to an alleged superior alignment of TIMSS to the U.S. curriculum, because in the next period, the pattern was reversed. From 2006 to 2009, PISA and NAEP scores both rose, while TIMSS scores were flatter. We're aware of no reasonable explanation for these erratic patterns, but they suggest to us that caution is called for before drawing conclusions from any single test about international comparisons, or indeed about anything else for that matter. Extensive educational research in the United States has demonstrated that students' family and community characteristics powerfully influence their school performance. Children whose parents read to them at home, whose health is good, who do not live in fear of crime and violence, will on average achieve at higher levels than children without these educationally relevant advantages. Aware of these relationships, education analysts in the United States pay close attention to the level and trends of test scores disaggregated by socioeconomic groupings. It would be foolish to fail to apply this same understanding to comparison of international test scores. Let me at this point turn it over to Martin Carnoy, professor of education at Stanford University, to continue the discussion of our report.
Thank you very much, Richard. I'm going to, rather than do something completely different, simply emphasize a few, I would say, sort of interesting findings that we are able to glean from the way we did the analysis rather than the way the analysis is usually presented. First, let me say that we are not attacking any of the tests themselves. It's each of these tests has its own methodology, has its own targeted students. In the case of the TIMSS, fourth and eighth graders. In the case of the PISA, 15-year-olds. In the case of the NAEP, also fourth and eighth graders. So the objective here is rather to show that by disaggregating the data by social class of the students, you find much more, I would say, policy relevant information than simply producing scores in an aggregated fashion for all groups combined. So, for example, we found that on the PISA reading test, although the U.S. does not score particularly high according to the aggregate results on this test, in 2009 scored roughly at the OECD average in the U.S., when we look at the data disaggregated by social class, we find that advantaged students indeed score as high as even students in the high-scoring countries like Canada, Finland, and Korea. And really, and even the disadvantaged students, the most disadvantaged students in the United States, score higher than in the most industrial countries, France, Germany, and the UK, which we use as a comparison, but did score considerably lower than students in the top-scoring countries. On the other hand, in mathematics, and this is in our table, in our figure B1, and in figures in P1 and B2, and in figures C1 and C2, on the mathematics scores, disaggregated, the interesting thing is that both that higher social class students or advantaged students score lower than all the comparison countries except for the UK, and the disadvantaged students, on the other hand, in the US, have shown considerable progress on the PISA. While, as Mr. Rothstein has said, the other countries except for Germany have shown declines in their disadvantaged student test scores. So for the in the case of mathematics, even though overall the U.S. Does not do as well in mathematics as in reading on this particular test, the PISA test, the lower social class or disadvantaged students do as well or better than the France, Germany, and the UK, and have made progress relative to even the top-scoring countries, while the differences there are quite large. But the important thing is that our advantaged students don't do as well in mathematics even as in France or Germany. So these are not the kind of policy conclusions that can be gleaned from simply doing aggregate scores. And they really are much more nuanced and provide the kind of information that leads to very different conclusions than simply. The other thing that I want to just comment on is the comparison between the TIMSS test and the PISA test. Again, nowhere do we judge which of these tests is better or worse. They're simply two different tests. In the case of mathematics, there is no. We didn't do a comparison between the PIRLS and the PISA because the PIRLS is conducted at the fourth grade, and the PISA is conducted among basically high school students. So we do the math score comparison, and again in the TIMSS, what's interesting is the very large gains at the in the TIMSS between 1999 and 2007. We will analyze the 2011 when the data become available in a few days, that there have been very large gains for lower social class students in the United States on the TIMSS test, which and gains which are consistent with gains on the NAEP. Again, by disaggregating by social class, the sort of modest gains on the aggregate scores in the TIMSS become very large gains for lower social class students in the same period. And again, that leads to a set of policy conclusions, which is very different from what, for example, Arne Duncan saw in the latest TIMSS results, which is very small gains in the aggregate scores. If we had seen these gains shown by different social class groups, I think that it would have been hard to draw the conclusion that our lower social class students have made very small gains, because I think the opposite will be true. The other thing is that, as Mr. Rothstein has pointed out, looking at just one test can also lead us to run around to look at examples of countries that are doing well, such as the Finland. Finland seems to have a very excellent school system, but in fact did no better than the United States on the most recent TIMSS test. So, again, caution is what our message is. I think there should be no problem for in the future for both the TIMSS and the PISA to present these data by social class, since they do so by gender. The scores for boys and girls separately, young men and women separately, and also the changes over time separately. So I'd like to now introduce Hans Wagemaker, who is the director of the IEA, which is runs the administers the TIMSS test. Hans?
Thank you, Martin. Let me begin by saying that I'm neither qualified nor inclined to comment on U.S. educational policy. I guess what I would like to say is that, you know, we would be the first to argue that average scores in and of themselves are not sufficient on which to base, you know, sound educational policy or thinking. And in fact, we provide a huge amount of data to begin to illuminate those factors which might explain average educational performances and differences among countries. And I think what I find useful in the paper is the fact that it begins to move the discussion away from the focus on the average. I think the other thing I think that's important, and something we've been arguing for some time, is that it's important as we begin to use the trend data that we understand the compositional effects over time, that since the 1995 data sets for TIMSS in particular, you know, we have more than 20 years worth of data, and we need to understand how the distribution and the changes over time in terms of its makeup, and that includes the lower performing students. We can't assume that given some of the changes in performance that you described for the lower performing students or the low SES groups, that these are exactly the same, composed in exactly the same way. And I would think that by now that most countries would begin to undertake these sorts of analyses. Our last data release was on December the 11th, and you know, which is not a lot of time to begin to undertake the more detailed analysis that's required for, you know, informed policy reform. Just one point of a clarification. I think Mr. Rothstein at the beginning raised the issue of the release of the public database. The issue here is that while countries have had a chance to work with the data for the last few months in advance of the international data release, we have been working on the international public database to ensure that the documentation that accompanies this is accurate, so that other commentators and researchers can use this in confidence that their interpretations are correct. I should have one final point, I think, too, that, you know, we have always reported performance looking at the lower with SES, with the SES variable. It's just that we compose it somewhat differently from the way that was done in the paper. And if you look at the TIMSS report, we have an index which includes the books on the home variable along with parental education and things like this, which is another way of looking at this data.
Thank you very, very much. We're very grateful that you took the time to read our report and to comment. Let me make one further note. In addition to sending the report in advance to Dr. Wagemaker, we also sent it to Andreas Schleicher, who is the director of the PISA for the OECD. Dr. Schleicher sent us written comments on the report. He was not able to participate in the conference call today, the press conference. And we have posted that, his written comments, as well as our response to his comments on the web. I think we're now ready for Q&A, and I think the operator will explain how this is going to work. Thank you.
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Again, to ask a question, that is star one. Our first question comes from Jill Tucker.
Jill Tucker from the San Francisco Chronicle. I know you explained this in the report, but I was hoping you could speak to it a little more, just sort of informally, about the use of books in the home as a way to identify social classes. I think that for the average person, that might be not intuitive, that might not be the way that they would identify a social class, and also given the changes of how books are purchased or acquired, you know, that's certainly something that's evolving. And so I guess specifically kind of a minor question, but, you know, in terms of online books and these kinds of things, are those accounted for? But if you could just speak to it, because I think the average reader, when they look at this, are going to be a little surprised at the identification of disadvantage by the number of books in the home. It's not something that is often used domestically.
Martin, shall I start?
Yeah, you can start.
Books in the home is a reasonable proxy for the kinds of social class differences that affect student achievement because it's an indicator of home literacy. The reason it's also been used very, very frequently by social scientists, and in our report, we show that produces the same kinds of results and trends that the use of PISA's index of many, many items called the Economic, Social, and Cultural Status Index. The reason we use books in the home for this report is because we wanted to be able to have a common measure to be able to show, to compare scores on TIMSS and scores on PISA. And it's the only social class measure. Well, mother's parental education is another, which also correlates highly with the books in the home. But books in the home is a measure which is common both to TIMSS and PISA, so we were able to do this combined analysis showing how social class trends on both tests compared. The PISA's index of economic, cultural, and social and cultural status is not used by TIMSS, so we could not employ that analysis in this report. Martin, do you want to add something?
Yeah, I just want to make clear that we have other people have used this. It's among social scientists, using books in the home is pretty common. It's a proxy. There is no, I would say, one measure that's used to measure social class, but so there are various measures. They're highly correlated with each other. The other advantage of books in the home is that it's a question that's answered by a very high fraction of the students who answer the questionnaire. Mother's education has more missing value, more missing observations, but in any case, we use the people that answered both questions, we used their answers to see what the correlation was between how much more would have been, how much our index would have improved if we had added these other measures, and the fact that there are these different indices. And as Mr. Rothstein has pointed out, this is a particular useful measure to compare social class between the different tests.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Walt Gardner with Education League.
Yes, Richard, with Walt Gardner out here in Los Angeles. You mentioned earlier that about disaggregating the data. Do other countries test, draw a sample of this, of the test takers the same way as we do in this country? I think this is an important distinction because there's been, unless I misunderstand, the other countries are tend to select their test takers from the upper classes. Am I wrong about this?
Yes, I think so. I think every country does its best to get a representative sample of students nationwide. But getting representative samples is very, very difficult, as we showed in the illustration I mentioned before on free and reduced price lunch status. PISA has a representative sample of disadvantaged children, but the sample of disadvantaged children is highly concentrated in schools with large proportions of disadvantaged children. It would be enormously difficult to stratify a sample on all the different variables that might interact in a large country. And so errors can occur. But I think every country attempts to get a representative sample of its student population. They don't specifically select just high-scoring or affluent students.
All right. So that, in other words, that's a misunderstanding on the part of many people who read these reports. Thank you.
Could I make a comment here, perhaps? What I can reassure you is that a huge investment is made in ensuring that all countries, and I'm talking particularly about PIMS, but it's also true, to the, as far as I know, for PISA, follow the very strict sampling procedures. The people that are involved in this are internationally recognized for their expertise in this field, and on completion of the sampling procedure and the test procedure, there is a separate and independent sampling adjudication process to ensure that when the data are reported, it adheres to the strict sampling standards. So there is no possibility that
it's cherry-picking, in other words.
Absolutely not.
Right, good. Thank you. That helps me a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. As a reminder, to ask a question, that is star one on your phones now. There are no questions at this time.
I think that we can go ahead and end the call now then.
Thank you.
This is Phoebe Seilig at the Economic Policy Institute, and I can answer any questions people have about the paper itself or how to reach Richard or Martin if they want to talk to him offline, or Dr. Wagemaker. Richard, would you like to close with anything?
No, I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope that you will take the opportunity to look at our report, which is now online, and send us any further questions or comments that you might have. Our email addresses are in the report, and Phoebe Seilig, as she just explained, is also available to help with any further questions you might have. Thank you.
This concludes today's teleconference. You may disconnect now.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Hans, for coming on. All right.